Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Glad you are back with us. We are thinking through God's word together. So glad to have you along. Hey, Rob and Megan and Spencer, what is up? And Child of Elohim, Nathan, and the rest of you, welcome. Glad you are with us. So we are doing an overview of what's called New Covenant Theology. And right now we are in the midst of seeing how the story of Jesus is progressing from the beginning. And today we're going to be introduced to the giant tree of the Old Testament forest. Today we encounter the big one. He becomes the foundation, the key character for the rest of the story, and we got to read it that way. And of course I'm talking about Abraham, which is interesting because, as we'll see, we're in Genesis and Exodus through the rest of the Old Testament. The major, character, if I can use that term, is Israel. And you could put King David in there, of course. But even the nation of Israel is tied to this very important person, Abraham, or as he's first called, Abram. So we're going to talk about that. So first we need to review. And I want to encourage you, do this. I know some of you are tempted, especially if you're watching this later or listening to this via podcast. You hear me start to review and you want to fast forward to get to the new part. Don't do that. Don't do that. One of the reasons why we misunderstand so much of the scripture is because we don't see it in the context. I talk about context as king, right? Well, in the New Testament, the context, when you're reading a verse, studying a verse, you need to know the context of the entire letter because there's a single message typically. There's a single purpose for Paul having written this letter or Peter having written this letter, for instance. And the Gospels are the same way. By the way, I got an email from someone asking about worshiping in spirit and truth and so on. And she had a very good and very specific question about that, and just, instead of just answering a question, I said, now go back and trace spirit and truth as John uses them, because he's got a purpose in what he's doing. And as you see the whole flow and the whole context of the Gospel of John, you begin to see what he means by spirit and especially truth, and what Jesus meant by worship in spirit and truth. Anyway, that's another time, another topic. But the point is, here in the Old Testament narratives, we're looking at the entire context of the story, not a theological context, not a system. God is not giving us a system. He's telling a story. So don't fast forward through the review. Make sure that you're reading this section in light of the whole thing. And I know it can get tedious, but stay engaged and you'll understand better. All right, so we have the creation. We have God making Adam and Eve in this lush, beautiful, fruitful garden. Everything they could ever want is there. And then a mission to make it better. And then the serpent comes and deceives the woman. She disobeys God. Her husband follows her and disobeys God. And we have God now pronouncing curse on all the parties involved. Now the ground is cursed, which makes it hard for Adam to do his work. And now the woman is experiencing cursing in that her job as having babies is now going to bring, or not going to occur with great pain. And the snake is cursed, and the other animals apparently are cursed, as he says that you'll be cursed more than all of them. So it's bad, it's hard, everything. It seems like this beautiful, wonderful creation and fruitful, thriving setting is now destroyed. But there's hope. In the pronouncements, God says the woman will have a seed who will crush the serpent. And it seems like, again, it's not explicit, but it seems like we are to understand that when this happens, it will not only destroy the serpent, but the evil effects of what he accomplished by deceiving the woman and getting the man to sin. You see, get what I'm saying? So there's hope here. There's someone coming who's going to crush that serpent and I think with him all of the ill effects of his work. So then you have humanity going about doing what they're told to do. Fill the earth with people, build civilization, conquer and subdue, rule the earth. And they do that, but they're wicked, evil people filling the earth. And so God is angry and he sends the flood and destroys all except Noah and his family. Then he tells Noah and his family, start over again, reproduce, fill the earth. And they do, and the world becomes corrupt again. This time, instead of crushing all of them, he scatters them and makes it so they can't communicate effectively. Right? And that's where we pick up in Genesis 11, verse 8. So the Lord scattered them from there, from Babel, across the face of the entire earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why its name was called Babel, because there was there the Lord confused the language of the entire world, and from there the Lord scattered them across the face of the entire earth. Now, we didn't talk about this yesterday, I don't think, but you know, now, from that point forward, you have diverse languages and people scattered all over the earth. It makes me wonder, again, just speculation, but it makes me wonder if this isn't where our different skin colors also began to, I want to say evolve, but I don't mean it the way the evolutionists do, that are different, you know, as people went to different parts of the globe and some of them got closer to the sun and whatever, you know, causes the melanin. I take melatonin for sleep. Melanin. Whatever causes the different colors of our pigments of skins, if that was also a result of people being scattered in new places and just over time, I don't know. Again, it's all speculation, but it makes sense to me that as God took this one people group with one language and spread them out, that there would be other changes that take place. You know, we talk about racism all the day. Just we're sick of it, right? At least I am. And if you understand what's going on, racism is being stirred up by those who want to create chaos and destruction. If they would stop doing that, most people today are not judging one another based on the color of their skin, but we've been provoked and taught that in school, and the government's doing it, and on and on and on. It's part of the, you know, the cultural Marxist agenda. But really, in terms of race, there's only one race. There's the human race. There are not different races. That's an evolution. The idea that there are different races is an evolutionary theory tenet. It is not a true one. It's not a big one. I got distracted by a comment there. There's one race. We all came from Noah. We all came from Adam, but Adam came from Noah. We all came from Noah, right? And there's one race, and I think that's a reason why we have distinctions of all that. All right, so then after this this summary statement about God scattering everyone, we read this. This is the account of Shem. And I wanted to point out here, I think this is the first, yeah. So the word account here in the Greek translation is the word Genesis. Right, that's why this book is called the Book of Genesis, because we've got several occasions here where the generations are articulated. This is the account of Shem. Shem was 100 years old, so Shem is one of of Abram's son, or Noah's sons. Shem was 100 years old when he became the father of Arphaxad, 2 years after the flood. So he's 100, and that's when he has his first child, apparently. And after becoming the father of Arphaxad, Shem lived 500 years and had other sons and daughters. All right, we're going to see this phrasing, other sons and daughters, repeatedly. When he lived 35 years, he became the father of Shelah. After he became the father of Shelah, he lived 403 years and had other sons and daughters. Oops. When Shelah had lived 30 years, he became the father of Eber. After he became the father of Eber, Shelah lived 403 years and had other sons and daughters. Eber had Peleg. He lived another 430 years and had other sons and daughters. And on and gone. Reu, same thing. Other sons. He became the father of Serug, other sons and daughters. Okay, so as you're reading this, and now you know that Moses wrote it, but I guess it doesn't matter for this point. Whoever captured this, whoever wrote this stuff down, obviously has a purpose. He's choosing specific lines of people, genetic lines, and showing us exactly who this one man became the father of. And then, oh yeah, he had other children. And that one, the guy he became the father of, he had a son and other children. What are we supposed to gather from this? This line is key in the story. All right, this is the line that goes back to the first man, Adam, down to Noah, and from Noah on down this particular line. So then we come to verse 24 of chapter 11. When Nahor had lived 29 years, he became the father of Terah. He became the father of Terah. He lived another 119 years, had other sons and daughters. When Terah had lived 70 years, he became the father, and now we get three, Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Then, verse 27, this is the genesis, the account, the genealogy of Terah. So this is the account of Terah. That phrase, this is the account of, doesn't occur every time, does it? No, because we're getting into the key. It's narrowing. It's like a funnel. It's like a funnel funneling down to our key figure here. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran became the father of Lot. He will be important later. Haran died in the land of his birth in Ur of the Chaldeans while his father Terah was still alive. Abram and Nahor took wives for themselves. Again, now we're getting some information that we didn't, that the writer here didn't care to articulate about the other people. Abram and Nahor took wives. And Abram's wife was Sarai. So like any story, if you're reading a good story, you've got all the setting and all the different characters and flowing along, but then you start, a good author brings you into these key elements of the key story. If you were just reading this along and you were aware, you would be, you would know, oh, we're moving toward an important, dramatic, climactic event. I don't know if climax is quite the right word. Catalytic event. This is important to the story, right? This, by the way, is why all the great stories follow this model, because all the great stories follow the model of the great story. The name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. She was the daughter of Haran, who was the father of both Milcah and Iscah. But Sarai was barren. She had no children. Again, why don't we get that information? Why don't we understand? Why don't we know who all the other men married and whether or not their wives could bear children? Because this is significant. Sarah was barren. She had no children. Now, you know this. You all are not first timers here, but just let this settle in. This was a big deal. I mean, for any wife who can't have children, it's a struggle. It's painful. But in that time, it was even more painful because they were striving to fill the earth, and they considered children great blessings. And carrying on the family name and having children to take care of you in your old age and all those things. This is significant for many reasons. And the author here wants you to understand Sarah couldn't have children. Terah took his son Abram, his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai. So again, we get the author is giving us the same information repeated. His son, Sarai, his son Abram's wife, and with them he set out from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to Canaan. When they came to Haran, they settled there. All right, so we are told in Acts chapter 7 that God called Abram when he was still in Ur. Okay, so we'll come back to that in a moment, but I want to show you. I just pulled up this map on DuckDuckGo, and I want to show you. It's a pretty good picture here. It's from the Bible History Online. You could just Google. I think I Googled Ur of the Chaldeans and came up with several of these maps. So here in this dark brown, for those of you watching, the dark brown, I think it's brown. I'm a little bit colorblind, so sometimes I confuse browns and greens and gray. So this is green, I apologize. But anyway, this darker shade area here, this is what will eventually become the Babylonian kingdom. Okay, and you see Babylon right here, right over from the camel. Well, if you can see down here, I don't know if you can read this, but this says Ur of the Chaldeans, and there's an arrow pointing to it, and Ur is right there. So in this area down here, can you all see my cursor? So that's Ur. That's where Abram lived, where he was born, where his family was from. And they are on their way over here, straight across, due west, to Canaan. But you see what's between Ur and Canaan, the Arabian Desert. So they don't just try to trek across the desert. They make their way up here, probably through Babel, whatever it was at that point, and on up and up north, and then they settle here in Haran. You see that up here in this lighter, kind of a yellowish area here in the Mari Kingdom. They settle there for a while. So they make their way up sort of northwest and settle in Haran. I think they actually took a little different route. But anyway, this is where they get to, is Haran. Now, eventually, then, Abram will make his way down here, come to Shechem, which is in this area, and then even eventually down here into the Negev, down in northern Egypt area. Okay, so that's where this is all going to take place. They're going to cruise up northwest, settle in Haran, and then make their way back here to this is the land of promise. And I'm getting ahead of myself. 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 I'm getting ahead of myself.
Then, are you all still with?
Oh, okay. I think I'm back. Give me a thumbs up if you're still with me. I had a technical issue on my end, but I think it's more on what I can see, not on what you can see. So if somebody would just give me a quick thumbs up to let me know that you're still with me, I would appreciate that. Streaming error. Are we, YouTube? Are we still? Okay, YouTube still has me. I don't know if we have anybody here on Facebook this morning. It looks like all the comments are from YouTube people and X. I never know if, all right, Jeff says we're back. So I'm assuming that means I was gone. Weird. All right. Well, hopefully we can continue here. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. So back to the story, Genesis 11. He set out from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to Canaan. When they came to Haran, they settled there. The lifetime of Terah was 205 years, and he died in Haran. So up there in the northern part that I showed you, that's where Terah died. What we now call chapter 12, verse 1. Remember, none of these chapter and verses are inspired. Moses didn't write those. Someone later wrote them, put them in just to help us identify where we're at. Now, the Lord said to Abram, go out from your country, your relatives, your father's household to the land that I will show you. So here in Acts, this is Stephen recounting his allegiance to Jewish history when he's on trial here, basically. He says, hear me, brethren and fathers, the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he lived in Haran and said to him, leave your country and your relatives and come to the land I will show you. See that? God appeared to Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he lived in Haran and said, leave. So if we go back to our map, whoops. There we go. Mesopotamia, can you see? I don't know if you, again, if you can see, I can blow it up a little bit here. The rivers Tigris and Euphrates. Mesopotamia is Greek for between the rivers. And that is between the Tigris and Euphrates. So that would be here at Ur down here, if you see it again. So Stephen tells us, and we don't get this straight from Genesis, but Stephen tells us when God said, go, Abram was still here in Ur. He was still here in Mesopotamia. And it was before he made it up here to Haran. So though it says that it sort of indicates that Terah took his family. Well, he did, but it sounds like God appeared to Abram and Abram said, we got to go. And they all said, okay, which is pretty cool. And the writer of Hebrews, of course, tells us just how great an act of faith this was. Abram, he grew up worshiping idols. Look here in Joshua. Joshua said to the people, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, from ancient times your fathers lived beyond the river. And he's talking about who is it lived beyond the river? Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. Then I took your father Abraham from beyond the river and led him through all the land of Canaan and multiplied his descendants. So Abram is there in Ur with his family and God shows up. So, and they were idol worshipers. And God appears to him. We don't know how exactly. We don't know when. It just, he shows up to Abraham, reveals himself as the one true God, or as the most high God at least. And he says, I want you to go to the land of, well, he doesn't even actually tell him where, does he? I want you to just pack up and leave your country and your relatives and go, and I'll show you that we're going to go. And they did. And his wife and his brothers and his father and the clan, they packed up and off they went because they trusted God. Doesn't it make you wonder? Again, just speculating here, but it makes you wonder, what did God do to convince Abram that he was the Most High God? I just wonder if there was some display, something. It seems odd that just a voice, especially if you're an idol worshiper, that a voice. But maybe it was the fact that no other gods could actually speak, and this God spoke to him. Who knows? But whatever it was, God convinced him that he is God, and convinced him, persuaded him to pack up and leave his country, his relatives, his father's household, and just go until I show you where I want you to be. That takes a lot of faith. And Abram did it. Do this, he says, then I will make you, Abram, into a great nation or a great people. Okay, so we got all the nations, all the languages, all the people groups on the earth after Babel. And God says to Abram, I'm going to make you a great one. You're going to be a great people. What does that mean? Obviously, he doesn't mean he's going to take Abram and make him more than one person. No, you are going to have a huge number of descendants. Right? From you, right? You're going to have children, and they're going to have children. And from you, as the root, the trunk of the family tree, from you are going to come multitudes of people and be this big, powerful, strong nation. Already you see the tension, don't you? His wife was barren and she had no children. not only did Abraham not have any descendants at this point, but we are told his wife was incapable of bearing children. And yet God says, leave Ur, and I'm going to give you so many offspring that this huge nation will draw its family line back to you as the head. He didn't have any children. His wife is incapable of having children. He believed him. And I will bless you. That's a very general, generic term for prosperity, for good favor, good things happening. And I will make your name great. People are going to know your name worldwide, or at least far, far beyond your homeland. People are going to know who you are, Abram. So that you will exemplify divine blessing. You're going to be an example. You are to be a blessing. In the Hebrew, it's a command. You are to be a blessing. So you're going to bless others. I will bless those who bless you. But the one who treats you lightly, I must curse, so that all the families of the earth may receive blessing through you. Now, I like this translation in the NET version because you've always heard this. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you, right? How many times have you heard that? Especially if you grew up dispensational. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse those who curse you. Isn't that the way it's said? The problem is the words that are translated curse in the normal English are two different words. And they don't mean exactly the same thing. And the NET does a good job here. The first word is a word for lightness, like light as a feather kind of thing. And so the idea is those who treat you with contempt, those who do not say, oh, you are Abram, the blessed one of God. Huh. I don't need to give you any regard. I don't need to treat you special. There's no special blessing on you from God. The one who treats you lightly or treats you with contempt, God says, I will curse. Same word is used in Genesis 3. I will bring some kind of punishment, some kind of you know, banishing from the ground, from the Garden of Eden, increasing your pain. Those are the ideas there in Genesis 3. And so if you treat Abraham as though he's not blessed of God, God's going to bring some kind of pain and suffering upon you. That's a pretty big blessing. It's like a, talk about a hedge of protection, right? I will bless those who bless you. So if you look at Abraham and say, you are under God's divine favor, then God will in turn put that person under God's divine favor. But if you treat Abraham as though he's not special, God will bring hard times on you. So that through you, Abram, all the families of the earth may receive blessing. How? How are all the families of the earth going to be blessed by God? Through Abraham. By acknowledging that Abraham has been blessed by God. Interesting turn of events here in the story. It seems like doom and gloom. It seems like the world is ruined, right? You've got Adam and Eve, the first two people, turn against God. They disobey and bring God's judgment upon the ground and all those things we talked about. And then they have children, and the first son murders the second one. And they continue to reproduce, and they fill the earth with wicked people. God destroys all but a few in the flood. They start filling the earth again, and next thing you got Babel, evil people, then now God has to punish them again. But this time he does it by scattering them and giving them different languages that can't communicate and so on. It just seems like the whole thing is ruined. This beautiful garden of paradise. And it's all ruined. But now God takes this one man and says, I am going to prosper you and bless you and protect you and attach everyone else's blessing to you. And in you, all the families. So you're going to have this great family. You're going to be this great nation. But through you, all of the families on earth will be blessed if they acknowledge that you are blessed by me. It's the second great message of hope, I think. You've got the promise of the coming seed who's going to crush the serpent. And then you have the progression of the line of the woman, the man, Adam and Eve, right? They're offspring, but through a particular line, because you see the family tree of Adam, you know, you see all these other branches branching off and other sons and daughters all the way here, but it just keeps following down here to this one great man, Abram. Great in the sense that he is greatly blessed by God, but also great in the fact that he had the faith to say, okay, yeah, I will pack up and leave everything. And we're going to see now, Abram is the focal point of everything that's going to happen in the story. Oh, I love it. Somebody needs to make a great movie of all this. I'll catch up on a couple of your comments here. Paul says Jesus is related to both Rahab and... Okay, well, that's getting ahead of the story. Hang on. there's a great mental institution in Haran. Let's go. Is there? Tara's response to revelation given to Abram is interesting, given Jacob's response to revelation given to Joseph. Meaning Tara's willingness to go, and then Jacob. What do you mean by that, Spencer? That's interesting. Opposite of Havad, heaviness, glory. Can you think of a New Testament passage that correlates the seed crushing the head of the serpent to the work of Christ? Can you? Yeah, Paul says, what great faith Abraham has. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that, and again, that's what the writer of Hebrews magnifies, right? He's willing to pack up and leave it all to go to whatever city God told him because he trusted that God's city is going to be the best. Yep, Paul's right. A redemptive plan is unfolding. And I know you know the rest of the story, but just try as much as you can to see it for the first time and watch it unfold. All right, we will leave it there for the day and come back tomorrow and look some more at what God's doing in Abram. Have a great one. Grace and peace to you all.